Are you someone who loves Christmas to the point that you really hate to take the decorations down, even if it's now January 15th? If you answered yes, you are a Noelophile. And so am I. And this show is for you. Hi, I'm Dot Cannon, also known as Noella Noelophile. And welcome to my Noelophile podcast. On this show, we're going to be talking about Christmas in general and California Christmas in particular.
Above him is a wreath. And all it is the dry twigs, but it has a big red bow kind of askew over to the corner there, and it's got a few little balls to give some color, and these little animals. This is different for our kids. You go to Texas, and it's kind of stark, and it's kind of different, but it was beautiful in its own way.
Author Evangeline Duran Puentes has a new Christmas book out this year. It's called A Tumbleweed Christmas, and while it's published as a children's book, it's actually a story that's appropriate for us big kids as well. A Tumbleweed Christmas is a bittersweet story of love, giving, and finding Christmas in unexpected places, told with a lot of warmth. Evangeline, this is your fourth book, but your first Christmas story. How did you come to write the story of A Tumbleweed Christmas?
Actually, it is based on a true story. I actually took my children from the city. We moved to Texas when my father-in-law got sick, and my husband is from Texas, and he had a small little farm with animals and whatnot, and he got real sick and asked my husband if he would consider moving back to help him out. So we did. So we took these two city kids and took them out to the country, and believe me, it was culture shock. And little by little, most of the things that you see, I mean, it is a fictional story, but much of it is true. It did happen. Everything from the Christmas tree, the tumbleweed Christmas tree, that was all true. And then, of course, the lady having a baby. And then, of course, I changed some things. But the going to a farm, learning about animals, learning about where food comes from, dealing with the prejudices of people, and living in a totally different atmosphere with the children, it gave me a lot to write about. It just did.
Let's look at some of what your two main characters are going through. Well, Maddie is really your main character, but what she and her brother Mark are going through after the parents announce we're moving to Texas. What happens with Maddie?
Well, Maddie just doesn't want to leave. They had just remodeled her room and painted it and did it exactly how she wanted it. And she was going to leave her friends and her school and the library club and everything. And she just, you know, she liked going for visits. She liked going in the summertime, but then it was always, you know, for a period of time, and then they would come back to California to normal living, as she called it. So when they actually were going to have to move and leave everything, it was difficult for her. Mark, not as bad. Mark kind of, you know, he was a little older, so he kind of, you know, took it in stride and figured, you know, we got to do this. We got to do this. We don't have a choice. But Maddie had a hard time with it.
I love how you have the interactions between Maddie and Mark all the way through the book, and I think the bedroom set from Miss Fern is a great way to illustrate that. Would you tell me about this?
Actually, that is a true part of the truthfulness of this story. That actually did happen. My mother's neighbor, our neighbor for ever since I was a little girl, Miss Fern and her mother, of course, the names have been changed, but they lived two houses down, and when Miss Fern passed away and then Miss Agnes passed away, the brother came in and was selling everything off, and my husband and I went down and decided we needed a bedroom set, actually, for Maddie, but we couldn't afford it at the time, so we figured if we could just get a bed, that would work. So, I mean, we got a deal of a lifetime, actually, and so we bought the furniture, and Mark and Maddie just, they went at it about Miss Fern, sitting there, and in the middle of the night, you're going to see her, and she's going to come and pull your feet. And so that was partially true.
I love how they scare each other, but at the same time, they do just about anything for each other. You've got this great vibe going on between the two of them.
Yes.
And you give Catherine a couple of great mom moments. I had guessed that you were Catherine.
Yes, I'm Catherine, and Greg is the father. It's my husband, Ray.
Greg is a great character, too. You have Greg at one point, after the family gets to Texas, seeing this man walk by with an old horse, a very sick old horse named Tony. How do you use that to illustrate the kind of person Greg is?
Well, throughout the book, it tells you he's kind of a hard, stern man. You know, he believes in this is the way things are, and he doesn't vary too much from that. But there's a side to him that not too many people see. They just see, you know, the tough dad. There's a side to him that feels warmly for people, and he sees this old man, and he figures maybe he needs help. So he stops, wants to help the old man, and then finds out that the old man was going through a hard time and trying to do something with his horse that was dying. And so he felt sorry for him and said, let me do this. You know, maybe it'll help the kids, whatever. I don't think he really knew what he was going to do with the horse, but he was going to try. And it was a good lesson to teach the children. So I wanted to show a different side of Greg. I wanted to show that he wasn't just a tough dad, you know, that he did have a heart. And I think that came off pretty well. And actually, that part of the story was not true. We did get Tony, and Tony was very, very sick, but he was actually, when we went to pick up Pocahontas, Tony was there. And the owner of Pocahontas told us, if you want that horse, you can have it. But of course, because it's fiction, and because my mind runs with fiction, I changed it in the story a little bit, just to give it more character.
In real life, did the horse Tony recover?
Yes, he did. He did. He did beautiful. He turned into a beautiful, beautiful horse.
A Tennessee Walker, you mention in your book.
Yes.
In your story, A Tumbleweed Christmas, Christmas is starting to come and things are very different for the kids. What's most different for these two children from Southern California when Christmas is approaching in Texas?
Well, first of all, they want snow. Maddie is dying to see snow, and being that she couldn't get her tree, here in California, you can go the day before Christmas and pick up a tree, and there's trees here, but waiting and not getting a tree and holding off, she was kind of disappointed. So the next big thing is, okay, we're going to have snow. We want snow. And of course, Mark, being who he was, you know, being a little more sensible, saying, yeah, you want a lot of snow, but wait till it gets cold and we're freezing our behinds off. You know, you're not going to think so.
I very much hear the big brother, right down to his calling his sister Squirt, all the way through this.
Yeah.
This is great. Would you read to me from A Tumbleweed Christmas?
Sure. Anything in particular?
Well, I love the scene where the kids find out Uncle Pat is coming, but pretty much I'll leave this up to you, whatever you'd like to share, and then we can talk about it.
All right. There's a paragraph that I have that kind of pulls it all together, I think, of these two city children coming from California to Texas, where it's so, so different. And if you don't mind, I think I'll read that little portion there. It's not very long.
Sure, please.
All right. Leaving everyone and everything they had ever known had been a difficult transition, and yet neither child had caused a fuss. Leaving the grandmother and grandfather, uncles, aunts, and cousins they had all been raised with created a hole in their lives that they struggled with daily. Still, they had made the best of the move and were trying in every way possible to adapt and make their new lives and lifestyles progress without too much hassle. Tomorrow, Uncle Pat would be there, and he'd be the Band-Aid for their ouch, and life would be a little less stressful and a little more like it was in California. That's it.
I love, first of all, I love that phrase, the Band-Aid for their ouch. Because you explain a little bit before that exactly what, besides the move, is hurting them. I'm not going to ruin it by saying it, but it's something that tells us that these children understand some of the realities of life. And I also love that Maddie and Mark aren't really bratty or spoiled in any way. It's like they have a great deal of maturity.
Yeah, and I think that has to do a lot with the way Greg was. Greg was a no-nonsense kind of person, you know. He had been raised by his dad that way. His father was that way, and I think I show that as they get to Texas and they meet Grandpa. Grandpa was no nonsense, just like Dad. You know, this is what we have to do, and we're going to do it. And I think that's why the children were the way they were. There was no room to get spoiled. They were loved. They were given whatever they could afford, and it was okay. But this transition, going from city life that was fairly easy, to show them that, you know, life elsewhere and a lot of the food that you get, it's hard work. You know, someone out there is doing all the hard work so that you can go into the store and buy that little package of beef or that bottle of milk or whatever. And I wanted to make sure that children could relate, could understand. You know, it's easy for us to go to the store and buy, but somebody somewhere there's an animal, there's a person, there's somebody doing something on somewhere far away for my convenience. And I wanted that, you know, in my stories, Dot, I try real hard not to give a lesson, but to make it known, you know, let children or the reader, any reader, know that life isn't always what we think it is. Sometimes there's a change, there's differences, and we should know about them because we take a lot for granted, you know.
I love another lesson you teach further along where Maddie and Mark don't get invited to a Halloween party, and you seem to be teaching a lesson about resourcefulness.
Yes, yes, because, and that actually was a partial truth. They were different, and so were George and Paula. They didn't get invited. They were new. They were different. They came from California where they had palm trees. I mean, you know, these were different kids. But George steps in and says, you know, that's okay. You know, we're different, but we can manage. We'll be okay. And Maddie, being who she was, why don't we get together? You know, we all have to eat. You know, can't we eat together? And then we make it a party. It doesn't have to be one of their kind of parties. We can have a party. And in the end, it turns out they got to be the, you know, the talk of the town because, or the talk of the school, because they did have a party and they had a lot of fun. They didn't need to be with everybody else and doing the same thing everybody else was doing. They did their own thing, and it was okay.
And I really love reading that, and also love that as a storyteller, you can weave in the darker elements, like they're dealing with prejudice. They have dealt with tragedy before, but you don't make it a depressing story. What's the technique for doing that when you're writing a book like this one?
Well, I think children everywhere, as well as adults, face adversities like that. And I don't think, in my own personal view, I don't think it's a good thing to dwell on things like that. Yes, there are other people out there that don't like this and don't like that, and you have to deal with it sometimes. But you know what? We should be grateful to be alive and to wake up every morning and be able to go outside and be able to see the sunshine or the rain or whatever it is. And I just don't believe that people should be depressed all the time because of other people's adversities or other people's opinions. Go out and do your thing. Be happy to be alive. You know, there's a lot out there to be grateful for.
And you emphasize the richness that Maddie and Mark have with their family, with what they're learning from the parents and grandparents, and actually almost offhandedly with their music, because at one point you have George saying, whoa, I didn't know you could play guitar like that, dude.
Yeah, and that is a true thing. My son plays beautiful guitar, and my daughter has a beautiful voice. I, on the other hand, have no talent for that. They got that from my father. Their grandfather could sing and play guitar, as did my brother Ed, who's also in the story. He's long past now, but my children both got musically inclined, and don't ask me. They didn't get it from me, that's for sure.
You give Ed almost a cameo appearance, and he says one of the best lines in the book. I just wish you would share that with me, what Uncle Ed says.
Oh, yes. He always used to say, hugs are free, but so very valuable, you know? And he used to give the best hug. My brother really did. And everybody, all his friends, even to this day, they talk about, you know, the hugs that my brother Ed used to give.
Now, as we get to Christmas in Texas, what were some of the elements of Texas Christmas traditions that you explore in Tumbleweed Christmas?
Well, first of all, I put in that part about when they're at the tree lot and they're looking for a tree and they see this little old cowboy sitting there and he's whittling away these little ornaments, these little animals and stuff to put. And above him is a wreath. And all it is the dry twigs, you know, the branches from the tree. There's no leaves on them. There's no needles or anything. But it has a big red bow kind of askew over to the corner there. And it's got a few little balls, you know, to give some color. And these little animals. This is different for our kids. For my children, anyway. They were used to the great big green wreath with, you know, all the goodies on it and all the beautiful stuff. And you go to Texas and it's kind of dark and it's kind of different, but it was beautiful in its own way, you know. And the little old man tells them, here in Texas, you got to kind of get your tree early because otherwise there aren't none. You just got to do what you got to do. That's different for them. They weren't used to that. Of course, Maddie all along kept saying, if we don't go, we're not going to get a tree, but not that she really knew what was going to happen. But as far as traditions of getting together the Christmas Eve, that's something very real for us. We celebrate Christmas Eve first. We have 2 days of celebration, and Christmas Eve is the big day for us. Christmas day, people usually go to church or whatever they do, and then you have the big meal. But the day that we celebrate so vividly is really Christmas Eve. And so I wanted to make sure that we carried that to Texas, because in Texas, family was doing the same thing. It wasn't going to be a little different there. We were still going to have Christmas, you know.
When you say Christmas Eve is the big day for us, what are some of your traditions?
Well, we normally make tamales either that day or the day before. That's something that's a big thing with us. We make tamales, and I make what we call champurrado, which is it's a Mexican hot chocolate, but it's a thick chocolate. It's not thin, you know, made just with milk. It is thickened, so it's a little thicker, and it has cinnamon, and it has a little bit of cayenne pepper and a little bit of nutmeg, just little spices to make it different. So that's something that we normally have Christmas Eve. That's our dinner for Christmas Eve. And then towards the end of the night and at midnight, my father used to bring, he used to put a big nativity scene, because we were all Catholic, and he'd bring the baby Jesus around for everybody to give a kiss to the feet, and then he would place it in the manger. That was something that we did when I was growing up. Now, as I raised my children, we did it a little bit differently, because I wanted them to know more about different religions and, you know, explore what's out there and not be forced into just one religion. But that's just me and my family. But cookies and having, you know, food to eat and people over and eggnog and hot chocolate, that's very traditional in our house.
I'm thinking, I'll be right over if you're going to have Mexican hot chocolate and tamales. Let's look at what's happening for Maddie and Mark when they get to Christmas Eve. Uncle Pat is coming, and what happens?
Well, Uncle Pat's coming, and Dad goes to go pick him up at the airport, and Mark and Maddie take off and go shopping with George and his mom and Paula. But here shows up at the door this gentleman who doesn't speak really good English. He has a very thick accent, and he's standing at the door there, and Catherine goes to the door, and this gentleman is saying that he understands that they don't have a tree, and he lives on a big ranch, and his boss told him that if they needed a tree for the kids, he could go out and chop one down. And actually, the one who was adamant about doing that was Esperanza, the wife. She insisted that this was, you know, Christmas, they were children, they needed to have a tree and whatnot. So this gentleman comes to ask permission to bring a tree, to make sure it was okay. He was a friend of the mother-in-law, so Catherine, taken by surprise, you know, says, okay, we're willing to pay. We just couldn't find one. He says, oh, no, this is a gift. So he leaves. He comes back, brings the tree. And, of course, it's not a traditional pine tree or fir or Douglas fir. It was actually a cedar tree. It was like a round, short ball, kind of sparse in the leaves. The leaves were different than the pine needles off of a regular Christmas tree, but the cedar smells beautiful, if you've ever smelled cedar. And this gentleman and his wife actually bring this tree in. It does look like a tumbleweed. It's round, and it's exactly what it looked like. And then as the story goes, you know, she goes into labor, and this woman actually did. She did go into labor and have her baby that day. She was the one with the axe chopping down the tree, because she wanted the children to have Christmas, you know, to have the tree and the smells and whatnot. So while they're gone, the children are gone, when they get back, they see this round ball. This, to them, it looked like a tumbleweed. You know, what is it doing here? And Maddie is just, you know, beside herself. This is not a tree. She's a little kid, and she, you know, and a bit assertive with her mouth. So she lets everybody know this is not a Christmas tree. And then, of course, you know, the story goes on, but that really did happen.
Without ruining it, what does Maddie learn from Pedro and Esperanza's gift?
Oh, gosh, Maddie learns so much from them. She learns that you don't have to know someone, you know someone and their ways and their culture and who they are and what they are, to be kind, to be generous, to be wanting to do for someone else. You know, you don't have to know a person, but a person is in need, and you step forward and you do something about it if it's within your power. And that's what Pedro and Esperanza did. They knew the children had a need, and they filled it they filled that need. They didn't worry about themselves, especially Esperanza. She was pregnant and ready to have her baby. She didn't care. She wanted these children to have something. And I think Maddie learned that, and it doesn't have to be exactly what you have in your head, because sometimes you have a vision in your head of what you want. You don't get it, you get disappointed, and then what you do get is better than what you had in mind in the first place.
You get the impression that Maddie will be forever changed from the gift that she gets from them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Who is the real-life Pedro?
Do you know that he actually is a real person, and so is Esperanza? Their names are changed, of course, but they were real people, and they were friends of my mother-in-law. Actually, she was a stepmother-in-law. She wasn't my real mother. My real mother-in-law passed away when my husband was 12. But my father-in-law had remarried, and Pedro was a friend of hers. And in conversation at the feed mill where they went to go get some feed for the cattle, they were talking about Christmas and whatnot. And that's how Pedro found out that they were disappointed because they couldn't find the tree and it was too late to get one. So Pedro was a real person, so was Esperanza.
You said in a note at the very end of your book that writing his dialect was a little bit of a conflict for you. Why?
It was because he had such a thick accent. I didn't want to offend anyone. I didn't want to be politically incorrect, if you will. And I was torn between writing it with just regular English, because that wasn't Pedro. Pedro actually spoke with a thick accent. And after much deliberation and conversations with my editor, we decided that we would give Pedro his true voice and let him be who he was. He was a very kind, generous man, a loving man, and I'm very proud to actually have known him. So Pedro speaks the way he spoke.
In fact, Pedro reminds me of someone I love very much, someone I grew up with. And what happened for Pedro after the story and the tumbleweed Christmas?
He went on. The real Esperanza did not pass away, by the way. She didn't. That was part of the fiction that went into the story. But Esperanza is, if I'm correct, is still alive and well with Pedro, living somewhere in the Fort Worth area.
That's wonderful to hear. And they probably have their child who celebrates Christmas every year.
Every year, and probably a few more. So
I'm impressed when I read A Tumbleweed Christmas that Maddie and Mark aren't excited about, oh, I might get a bicycle, I might get a computer, I might get a whatever. It doesn't seem to be about that. It seems like they're excited about snow and Christmas trees and Uncle Pat coming. That I thought was great.
Yeah, and that was important. And that's the way the kids were, believe it or not. They were more excited about, at first they didn't know that Uncle Pat was coming. And then when they found out, I mean, that just made it for them. But they were excited about snow and being with their friends and doing things that were a little bit different. And the disappointment came when they couldn't get a tree and they couldn't do some of the traditional things that they were used to doing in California, you know, where when things didn't really go their way, they would get on their skateboards, go up the hill. And that's part of the story's true. We lived on a corner lot and down at the bottom of the hill, and they'd go up that hill and they'd come flying down. And they used to say that the wind in their hair used to take away all their troubles and all their problems. They could just blow in the wind and they would be fine. So when they came to Texas and they didn't have that, everywhere is flat. Everything was flat. It was a big transition.
But what magical children you have.
Well, now they're old and grown. I mean, my son is in his mid-40s and my daughter early 40s, so it's different. And I dedicated the book to them because I said if it hadn't been for them and their antics, I wouldn't have been able to write that story, you know.
You give Pedro some grandmother wisdom towards the end of the story. Now that you're a grandma, what do you really want to pass on to your grandchildren about Christmas and about family?
I have only one grandchild, a grandson, and he's now 23. And I think the most important thing is that material things don't matter, but family does. And when you're sick and you're old, as I am now, I'm an older lady and whatnot, what's important to you is having your family around you. And your friends, because you know what? Family are not just your blood relations. I have daughters and sons and grandsons that are from other mothers and grandmothers, but they're still mine. So I have sisters, but I call sisters of the heart, that are not my blood sisters, but they're like sisters to me. And I want him to know that, and I think he does. You don't have to be related by blood. You can be family by association, by love, by your heart. And that's more important than having a brand new car or having money in the bank. I mean, that all helps, but it's not that important. Because when you're down and out and you're sick and you're dying, no money, no car, no material things are going to make you feel better. It's that family that stands next to you and says, hey, I'm here to say hello and see how you're doing. That's what makes you feel better.
That's about the most important Christmas gift I think we could give our listeners right there. Where can they find your book, A Tumbleweed Christmas? What is the website?
You can buy it on the website or you can go to Amazon.com and just put my name, Evangeline Duran Fuentes, and my books will drop down. Or you can go to the website, which is www.dreamsthroughwords.weebly.com.
Dreamsthroughwords.weebly.com.
Uh-huh.
Evangeline, thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Dot. It's been wonderful talking to you again.
You and I have been listening to Evangeline Duran Fuentes, author of A Tumbleweed Christmas. You'll find A Tumbleweed Christmas, as well as Evangeline's three previously published books and her latest book, Waggles, on her website, dreamsthroughwords.weebly.com. That's Dreams Through Words, we're spelling through THRU, dreamsthroughwords.weebly.com. And that concludes this edition of Noelophile. Thank you for listening. And may your Christmas be filled with love, warmth, creativity, and all the other things that really matter.